Welcome back to the Puck and Pod. On today's episode, we'll be discussing NHL free agents still unsigned, NHL offer sheets, present and past, and our favorite summer movies of all time. That's coming up next on the Puck and Pod. Let's puck and go. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is episode number 2. Here we are. It's the Puck and Pod. My name is Joe. For those of you who don't remember from our last episode, I'm joined by Brandon.
Yeah, man. We're
and
here.
Paul.
Howdy, howdy.
Gentlemen, how are we feeling today?
Feeling good, man. Coming into a long weekend. We got Friday tomorrow. We're recording on this lovely Thursday. The weather's supposed to be absolutely fantastic this weekend.
We get summer back.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
We got a couple of big plans, actually. A buddy of mine's given us a inflatable boat.
Ooh.
One of those Mariner ones, ones you can attach the canopy to it and everything.
Slick.
And we've got oars with it. I'm not in shape at all to blow it up with a manual pump. So we're going to stop by Canadian Tire sometime this weekend, grab one of those electric ones, like $18 or something.
Nice.
So it's going to be fun, I think. Take it out on the lake.
I think getting out with the family and relaxing is always a good thing to do just before September hits and the weather drops and everything turns to misery. We're lucky, I think, where we live in that it doesn't actually turn all that to miserable right away. We might even get a nice October.
I think fall has definitely arrived, though. Like, yeah. Summer's getting its last little breath in here, but it's getting colder. It's getting damper.
You got anything going on this weekend, Paul?
Just my usual work. I did a couple of things this past week. Went down to Victoria with a friend and took my son out to the Beacon Hill Animal Park. He loved that. Had a lot of fun with that.
My kids love that place too. Yeah. It's so much fun. If you're not familiar, they have a lot of like free roaming animals, and yeah, one of them do. In particular is the peacock. And this peacock will attack people. It'll like chase after people and stuff. It's really funny. But the kids absolutely love that place.
They do like a morning goat run. So yeah. Like everyone stands by and they let, I think it's like something like 20 or 30 goats that run right by them into their stalls. Let the goats know to go there. So it's fun. And the later part of that afternoon, we went to the Royal Museum. And my son was really into learning a lot of stuff at the museum. He kept asking
cool.
questions.
And he's only, I love the museum,
favorite
man.
Pastime of mine. Yep.
Not even 5 years old yet. He's asking a ton of questions about it. So. It's good.
Puck and Pod. So what's happening in the puck world?
I think one thing we can probably get started on is talking about free agency this off season. Speaking of the off season, you know, the cool thing about the NHL is that it's kind of, there's always something going on. Even in the off season. So let's talk about free agency. What do you guys think about free agency this year?
Well, we've got the coverage up here in Canada. I know we went down to the United States for a couple of the Blue Jays games in July. And no matter where you looked, there was nothing hockey anywhere. Whereas in Canada, no matter what's happening, you're always going to find some coverage on hockey. And it was interesting to see the cultural differences down there. A lot of the time, baseball obviously is big, but soccer at the time, because it was the Euros. But having the information up here is so valuable to us. And what do you think about some notable restricted free agents, Paul? I know there's a few pretty serious ones out there.
Yeah, like one of the big ones that you're kind of surprised he hasn't been signed yet, because he was there. He's the one that basically carried them through the playoffs up until they lost to Florida, which was it's Jeremy Swayman right now at Boston. He hasn't been signed yet. I don't know if it's a cap space issue or what it is, but. You would have thought that's something they would have taken care of like right off the bat.
Well, I did read today that apparently they've been negotiating since March.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they've been trying to negotiate a contract since March. And I thought they did a good job in the offseason of clearing out space. I mean, maybe not.
So the question really remains with Swayman is, if they have been, in fact, talking all this time, is what is the holdup? What is it that they're indifferent about?
His entire demeanor the season, a couple of off-season interviews he did, like right at the end of the off-season, he did nothing except pump up the Bruins and talk about how he basically wanted to be there. And it is confusing how he's still not signed. I mean, you'd think it's a money thing, probably not a term, because he'll want to be there as long as he can.
Must be a money thing.
Yeah.
I would think, you know, because they're maybe banking on his one full year of having been a starter compared to, I guess, the previous seasons where he's been a bit of a backup. Maybe they want more. I don't really know. I don't get it.
It definitely can't be a term thing because he's only 25.
Yeah.
I mean, at that age, you're 32 after a 7-year contract. There's still plenty of time left to play in the NHL at that age.
Yeah.
Especially as a goaltender.
As a goaltender. You can go into your 40s as a goaltender and still be useful. Maybe not so much a starter, but still be useful.
And I think we all know there isn't really a formula anymore, or has there ever been, really. At one point, you could probably gauge based on other contracts of what somebody may get. It doesn't seem to be the case anymore. You know, he was making almost, what, 3.5?
Yeah.
The last couple of seasons. 3 consecutive 20-win seasons in a row on a team where you're basically tandeming goalies
with
Allmark and whatnot.
Yeah.
What is he going to make? Is it going to be 6 or is it going to be 10? Like, you don't know. You have no idea.
I can see Boston paying him when they finally do sign him. I can see them paying him somewhere in the $6 to $7 million range. But that's just because, like, star goalies tend to get that kind of weight, that kind of range, you know, when it comes to the money they make. But yeah, it really depends on what they have available and, you know, what can they agree on. Maybe he'll do a bridge deal, but just to get them to, you know, just to get him signed to UFA status.
And important kind of before there. Important before training camp, right? If we're looking at, I guess, a couple of the other guys here, like Detroit has 2 big ones with Sider and Raymond. Neither of those guys have been signed, and Sider is like huge for their decor. Raymond
is the biggest. Yeah, when you think about the importance of the player, like Sider's got to be one of the most important players for Detroit. He's the future of Detroit.
Defenseman 25 years or under, who is higher on that list than maybe Cale Makar after Sider?
Yeah.
He's turned himself into such a pivotal part of that lineup, like, of any lineup, if you were to be on it.
You compare him, so you've got Makar, you've got Hughes, you've got Sider,
Hughes, I guess, would be the
Yeah, then you've also got, you know, Fox.
Is Fox under 20 or 25 and under, though?
No, uh-huh. he might be above 25. He might be 25, 26. 26.
Yeah, just, I mean.
So, you know, okay, so let's say 25 and under. Yeah, you've got Hughes, you've got Makar, Bouchard.
Oh, Bouchard, yeah. Yeah, hell of a year, yeah.
Bouchard. He had a great year. I'm still unsure about Bouchard. I know every Oiler fan out there is going to be like, he's a stud. I'm sure he is a stud. But the thing about it is like, he needs to have consistent seasons to be in that position, to be in that you know, ranking. So
Rasmus Dahlin, of course. Yeah. Can't forget about that guy.
Right. Yeah, it's
Noah Dobson. Holy smokes.
There are some incredible defensemen in this league.
Yeah, there are.
And I think it's funny because you think back to, I know this is totally off topic, but you think back to, like, you know, 10 years ago, there would never be a defenseman that is under 6 feet, you know, that is in the ranking for best defenseman in the league. So yeah, the game itself has changed a lot over the years.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Like, it's, you need mobile defensemen. You need ones that are going to be able to carry the puck for you. Like, the forwards are good at, you know, possession and such, but you need somebody that's going to get the puck up to those forwards. You know, it's now today's NHL.
A first pass isn't good enough anymore.
No.
That was always in the scouting report. Oh, he makes a good first pass. Doesn't matter if he can't skate.
That's right.
It doesn't matter. Exactly.
Yep.
You know, if we're talking about, again, notable defensemen that are still restricted free agents this offseason, Thomas Harley is another one. With Dallas, he had definitely a breakout year this year with Dallas. Again, what's the holdup? Jim Neal actually traded away a guy like Ty Dellandrea, who was actually was a notable center for them, so that they would have extra cap space for Harley. He's definitely one of their notable lefties. Like, Heiskanen obviously is their top guy, and then you have Lindell, who's their second guy. You know, it's important to get a young guy like that signed to a pretty good deal, and it's kind of surprising that it's been dragging out this long right now.
Carolina has a rough spot in my mind with their current RFA they need to sign in Seth Jarvis.
That could have been a Leafs pick.
Oh, don't even say it. Just stop.
Love you, Patrick Marleau, but at the same time.
Cap dump.
Yeah.
First round pick. Here you go. Well, no big deal. Just Seth Jarvis.
Yeah. You know, the thing about it is I thought about this a lot because I was watching a video earlier today about the Canucks and, you know, the terrible drafting they had throughout the early, like the mid 2000s to like 20, I think it was like 20, well, since Jim Benning took over, basically up until Jim Benning took over. So like Gillis was drafting nobodies, basically. And not only that, but Bonus? What's his name?
Nonis.
Dave Nonis was also drafting nobodies prior to him up until that point. And it was like, there was literally a video I was watching that was describing all the players that they picked. And, you know, let's say between the 4 years, you know, that they were talking about, like three of them made it to the NHL, but played only like 10 games. It's crazy when you think about it, all of the picks that they had, that they just drafted nobodies. And it can happen to anybody, but it, you know, giving up on players that end up being like all-stars, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, from a Leafs perspective, when was the last time that they drafted a stud defenseman?
Morgan Riley?
2008?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of prospects that could pan out, but it's not like you're saying to yourself, okay, in 2 years, he's going to be NHL ready, and it's a guarantee.
But you know, the sad thing about that too, if you think prior to that, maybe Thomas Cavalier, but even then, he wasn't even a first-round pick. I'm pretty sure he was the seventh-round pick.
I mean, and that's just how it is, right? Sometimes if those picks work out. Yeah, it's frustrating sometimes as a fan when you look back and you're just like, how could they have looked at this guy the way they did and then let all these other guys go? Like, how can you imagine this player as being better than these players? But I think about a player they did draft, the Canucks did draft, in Jordan Schrader, who was predicted to be a really, really great player, and then just nothing happened with him.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a high goal scorer in the, I think it was the American Junior League. I can't remember what the U.S. is. It the USHL, I believe.
USHL is the development league.
Yeah. He was like a 50 goal scorer or something like that in the USHL, and then you just like nothing ever happened with him.
He's still only 33.
Yeah, like he, you know, if he had the skills, he could still be playing in the NHL. But he, unfortunately, he's basically been a career AHLer, you know? So, yeah, it's unfortunate. But this is a story amongst a lot of teams. So he was 22nd overall. I thought it was like 9th overall for some reason. But even then, you know, that's still a decent draft pick, you know, for the time. Brock Besser was picked, I think, 25th overall. So you consider... You know, like the studs you can get.
You have players, obviously, in the later part of the first round that, you know, they're projected to be NHLers, but you can't tell whether they're going to be star players or not. Look at Scott Gomez, right? He turned out to be fantastic, at least for the first part of his career, not so much in the second half of it. But again, late round.
Yep. Speaking of star players, who else you got in the RFA list? Brandon's got Cole Perfetti as one of the names up there too.
I put that down just because he's been in talks a lot lately about being traded.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because Winnipeg's having trouble signing him. He doesn't want to play there. I don't think it's really been publicized what his thought process is around the whole contract thing, but there's lots of people talking about.
It seems to be the common thing right now with Winnipeg where guys are kind of wanting out of there. I mean, no offense to anybody who's listening to this and they might be from the Winnipeg area, but it just seems crazy to me that all these players seem to want to get the hell out of there, you know? And it's unfortunate because, you know, we want hockey in Canada, but obviously we want players to want to play.
I'm not going to pretend to know exactly the reason, but I think there's a few points that you could make about that area. One is that it's cold as hell.
Yep.
You know, you get terrible weather for 8 months a year, if not more.
Yep.
You have an arena that is undersized.
Capacity
is like 14,000.
Yeah, just under 15.
And I mean, they don't even sell that out, I don't think.
Nope.
And then the other thing is that Winnipeg is kind of a standalone place in its area. You've got, you know, north, you've got a few cities. I work with a guy from Thompson. Mm-hmm. Winnipeg is kind of a standalone area. If you're flying in, there's like a little patch of lights and then there's nothing through the entire province, right?
Mm-hmm. Toronto's got a notable one right now that has basically said he is not going to sign with us. And that's Nicholas Robertson.
Good riddance. Get the puck out.
So let me ask you guys a question then based on that fact. Why do you think he doesn't want to play? Think reasonably. Why do you think he doesn't want to play for the Leafs?
Well, I know why he doesn't want to play for the Leafs, but it's unreasonable in my opinion. And it's basically he was underutilized for ice time. Okay. It's his view on it. Like, he wasn't utilized in a situation where he could excel for the most part. There were flashes where they throw him on the top line or on the top power play. I think he started the year on the top power play unit, to be honest. I think he probably had 7 or 8 games there. And he wasn't really producing. he was hitting a lot of posts. He was miffing on a lot of shots. Just, I don't know what the issue is, gripping the stick too hard. You can, you know, argue and debate that for hours. But being so injury prone that he has been, and I don't mean injury prone as in, you know, he's just broken. He's had a lot of freak accidents, but he just wasn't utilized by the previous coach, Sheldon Keefe. That could have been for many reasons, but he wants out because he wants more of a shot. Although maybe you can play on this point, Paul. What better opportunity would he have than right now?
Well, exactly. Like they lose Bertuzzi in the offseason here. There's basically a left wing spot opened up in the top six now. There's an opportunity for him to actually really, you know, really get engaged and to make a name for himself. I think part of his problem is that he is a bit undersized. And, you know, while speed is a good factor to have, if you're undersized and you have somebody bulldoze you over, you know, in Nick Robertson's case, you know, you're going to get injured pretty bloody easily.
Yeah. You can shoot the puck as well as anybody in the league, but if you can't get to this areas where that shot's going to be effective and they just push you to the outside, you're not doing anything.
Yeah. It's interesting because, yeah, like you say, like there is a possibility for him to play on the top six. Do you think that he's had that conversation with Berube and Berube said to him, like, I don't think you're the player I want in the top six?
Honestly, I don't think they can when they're restricted like that at that point. Like, he's been qualified. He's still technically part of the team. Mm-hmm. But I think probably his agent's even saying, don't talk to anybody until we get this sorted out.
Interesting.
And I would have a different perspective on that. And I would say, I bet you absolutely Berube sat down with him. Whether he's allowed to or not, I have no idea. But
Maybe he sent him a text even.
Who knows? Yeah. I guarantee they've had meetings and said, hey, man, there's a spot here. His agent, if he's any sort of agent at all, should say, bro, like, what are you doing? You could score 25 goals playing in the top six with probably John Tavares and Mitch Marner. Mm-hmm. You know, as the other players on your line, what are you doing? You know, there was a report the other day that said they were trying to maybe trade him to Dallas to play with his brother. Is that going to help? Is that going to hinder him? Like, he hasn't really established himself. Yeah. I don't really know what he's trying to do.
Yeah, like it really doesn't make any sense that he would hold off. Like, the person that was sitting him is no longer on the team. You know, like it's
that's why I asked that, because like if he actually had that conversation, it would have to have been with Berube. But like you say, if he's being instructed not to talk to anybody, then
you're bringing in three new coaches, two of them who are very offensive minded, and that's the entire reason they're there. He's there to play offense as a player. It seems like a Tetris match in heaven, and he just doesn't want to participate in the game.
Right.
And I mean, there could be other things going on that we don't know about. Who knows? Who knows what the problem is, right?
How are you going to get your name noticed? Because he even mentioned that he'll just go sign somewhere else, like overseas. How are you going to get your name noticed overseas? Like, yeah, there'll be scouts and stuff over there, but you're more likely to be seen in North America here than you are overseas.
And I mean, if you think about it being the hockey mecca in Toronto, and every little thing this guy does is scrutinized, do you think that a report was not going to get out? Like, clearly it's public. And it always will be public. And anything you say or do will be public. I'm not sure what he's looking for. Yeah. I really don't.
I'm very curious as to how that plays out.
And I mean, in the grand scheme of things, this is a very minor player when you're thinking about the entire
league. How it impacts
the team. We only know and have an opinion about him because he's plays for a team that we like.
Yeah.
And that we, you know, pay close attention to. Mm-hmm. Have you thought of an RFA where there's a bit of a holdout or anything in Canuckland that...
There's none. There's the only RFA that they had this year was Seeloff's, and they signed him for an $800,000 contract. I believe it was 2 years, $800,000 something. So
it was 2 years.
Yeah. So Canuck fans are really happy with that signing. So there's definitely no...
Did you see the news today about Seeloff's?
Yeah. Unfortunately, so for those of you listening and you're wondering what he's talking about, Seeloff's was announced today that he might have an injury or at least something that's nagging him. And it appears to be a knee, like an inflamed knee. So what I heard from the story is that it's not an actual injury, but they're worried that it could get worse if he continues to play. He was going to play for Latvia in the World Championships qualifier. They basically decided they're going to sit him out. I think the Canucks actually told them that he needs to not play because obviously he might be needed this year. If Demko is injured, he's going to be playing right away, right out of camp. So,
and I don't see why they wouldn't have any intention of trying to play him more anyway, especially for what he did in the playoffs.
That's right.
And signing him to a new contract, give the guy some confidence, let him play.
Yeah.
Demko, we know Demko can play. let Seelos play, see what he can do. Maybe he takes the reins with it, and you don't have to play Demko so much. Maybe this tandem goalie thing is starting to be a thing.
Yeah.
Same with Toronto, right?
I mean, agree.
We don't need to keep talking about Toronto, but it's the same idea.
I think across the league, you're starting to see more and more. They're playing with three goalies for the sake of trying to alleviate that stress on the number one goalie, right? So like Demko, he was definitely overplayed last year. So the major thing they're trying to do is they're trying to alleviate the workload so that he can go into the playoffs like ready to go. It's tough because obviously injuries happen and they can happen at the weirdest times. And, you know, with Seelos, I think the big thing is that one of the things I read in the interview that the Latvian coach did was that he said that he is a hard worker and he pushes himself. So even in the summer season, when, you know, this is the time to kind of try to rest your body, he's not doing that, right? And that can be scary, especially when the team needs you in the springtime. So
now, do you think the games become harder on the goalies and that's why their durability is not as strong compared to, say, you go early 2000s, late 90s, where, you know, you had goalies playing like almost 70 games?
I think that that's definitely an argument to be had. The only reason why I might disagree is because the way the game is played, it all depends on the structure of the team. So if a team is playing a defensive structure, then you're going to put a lot of pressure on the goalie. But if you're playing a sort of a two-way structure where you're able to transition the puck better and easier, then I think there's less of – you're giving your goalie a little less work. You know what I mean? They're not going down so often, stuff like that. So
I would love to go back to the 1-3-1, please.
Yeah.
Please.
I think that's sarcasm. I mean, go watch the LA Kings because they're still bringing it, bro.
That's true.
They're still bringing it.
How about back in the early 2000s, 90s, late 90s? You're talking about the early stages of Minnesota Wild and the New Jersey Devils back in the late 90s. Now, what were they giving up? 20 shots a game?
Yeah.
21 shots a game?
Yeah.
What are goalies giving up now? 40 shots a game? 45 shots a game?
Yeah.
Tired, injury, they're playing more. It's faster. They're left to right more. There's so many reasons you could argue, I think, 100%.
You'd have to argue the physicality of the game back then, too. Nobody wanted to go charging in because they get bowled over by somebody.
Yeah. I mean, the game has gotten faster. It's gotten more physical. Like, there's a lot of things you got to take into consideration when it comes to the structure of the game. But I think that ultimately, you know, goalies, it depends. Like I said, it really depends on the team. It depends on the coach, the structure of the team. If they're playing a defensive game, if they're playing an offensive game. Vancouver is an example. Like last year, they really brought the defense to their game. However, I think this coming year, they're going to focus a lot on offense, trying to score more goals. So we might see more goals go in for them, but it all depends on how that works out. So, and they could obviously change the structure throughout the season too. So,
yeah, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about RFAs, we probably should lean into the fact that offer sheets can be offered to these RFAs.
Yeah, offer sheets. So this is something that we don't see enough of, in my opinion. Like I think this is a great strategy for a team to be able to get a player that you covet when another team is kind of in cap hell. And I think this year is a perfect example of that. When you look at two offer sheets this year used on the Edmonton Oilers. Anytime somebody hurts the Edmonton Oilers, I'm perfectly okay with that. This is a Canucks fan here. Honestly, like, it's definitely really intriguing from the outside looking in. When you consider, you know, the players that they took, Philip Broberg, 2 years at $4.5 million per year, Dylan Holloway, 2 years at $2.2 million, both going to St. Louis because Edmonton didn't match either one. I'll be completely honest with you guys, that surprised the hell out of me.
Well, you know, in Edmonton's or St. Louis's case, they actually had to reacquire one of their picks and actually paid extra to get it so that they could do these offer sheets. That was the trade with Pittsburgh, where they reacquired their second round pick and a fifth round pick from Pittsburgh, and they had to pay a 2026 second round pick for the following year after 2025, and then a third round pick. So they actually kind of decreased their value. However, they needed that pick to make these moves happen because Broberg's offer sheet requires that second round pick.
What do you think that does with relationships in between teams. Specifically, I would say GMs, right?
Yeah.
Like Doug Armstrong came right out and said, you know, hey, if there's a rule or an unwritten rule about signing offer sheets, no one told me about it.
Yeah.
This is a guy who's been around the league 40 years. Like, you know, is there a code? What do you guys think? How do teams deal with that?
So my understanding of it is there is somewhat of a code. The code being, you know, if they want to keep a relationship with that team, they're going to do something to kind of boost the, you know, boost the relationship a little bit. And then I don't know if you're aware, but there was a trade made between the two teams after the Oilers decided not to match the offer sheets. And it was just sort of like a future considerations trade, but it's basically their way of saying, here's an extra pick or two just to help you out. Like to, you know.
So Paul, how do you think that affected the Oilers lineup moving forward with that offer sheet and the signing up?
Yeah. Like obviously they had to make some moves. It's kind of funny. They were kind of in the middle of making moves because they had a week obviously to decide to match or not. And they did trade away Cody Ceci, one of the guys that had a decent sized salary on the team. To the Sharks for just Ty Emerson. They had to put a sweetener in with a third round pick. And then they also acquired Vasily Podkolzin from the Canucks.
Fourth round pick.
For a fourth round pick. It was kind of strange though, because you would expect the fact that they were able to clear out CC that they could go 10% over the cap, that they would have still matched the offer sheets that have been given, and they declined. And obviously maybe it was for future signings for Draisaitl McDavid when they're in their free agency. You know, obviously with having to make the subsequent moves, it kind of baffled me that they didn't match. But
yeah, I thought for sure they were gonna match at least one of the players.
Yeah.
Like for me, I thought probably Broberg was gonna be the guy they hung on to. Just because he's a defenseman, he's a right shot defenseman who's still very young and still very skilled. Like he was very good for them in the playoffs. Holloway was good too, but I just, in terms of the value, I thought Broberg was going to be the guy that they hung on to. For them to give up both players just seemed pretty surprising.
I think it's pretty obvious as to why they went the value they did as far as compensation goes, because they kind of went right to the limit of that compensation for what picks they would have had to give up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's quite a bold offer for a player who's, I mean, had a great playoffs, but still fairly unestablished,
yeah.
A fairly young player, 4.57 or 5.75 or whatever, like literally $5,000 under the limit for what your compensation would be.
If it were to raise, that's right.
Well, and, you know, you'd make those trades any day of the week, a second or third round for Broberg and Holloway, just based upon their age and the potential that's ahead of them. Like it's again why I say it's surprising is that the value at the picks is, in my opinion, below what the value of the players are.
And I think that's where like offer sheets really become a weapon for GMs in the league. They can kind of utilize it so it works out in their own favor. Yeah, we pay a little bit more on our cap, but in the end, these are players that are going to stick with us for at least 2 years, so we can start establishing our team, rebuilding our team to a point where these guys will probably re-sign with us when it comes time to do so. I think it's a smart move on St. Louis's part.
Oh, completely.
Can you think of any other like really notable, either matched or not matched, you know, offer sheets that have happened in the last 10, 15 years?
Well, one that there's two offer sheets and they are intertwined with each other. It was when Montreal signed Sebastian Aho to an offer sheet. That was for 5 years, $42.25 million at the time. Carolina in the end did end up matching it and held on to Aho and turned out to be a superstar in the process of that. It's funny enough, when Jesper Kotkaniemi became an RFA, the Carolina came right back at it, gave him an offer sheet for just 1 year, but I believe it was 6.19.
It was
million.
Ridiculous. It was a ridiculous number.
Yeah, for a player that had not been established at all yet.
It was like his second, no, not second. It was like his third year. Like, I don't know. It was like right away after his ELC was done.
After his ELC. And you have to kind of laugh at it because Carolina, they never confirmed it, but they kind of jabbed at the Canadiens by giving Kotkaniemi a $20 signing bonus, which is the same as Aho's jersey number.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I like that.
I like it too.
It is fun to me. And that's a perfect example when you ask about the code, where it's kind of like, okay, you're going to try and do that to us. We'll do it to you. There have been some really, really cool offer sheets in the past.
Dustin Penner would be one of them.
Dustin Penner. Yeah. I go back even further. I'm looking at one, I think this might be the very first ever offer sheet, 1986. Gary Nyland was a player on the Toronto Maple Leafs. Chicago offered him 3 years plus option at a whopping $620,000. And he was not matched by Toronto.
Now, I wonder if that's a CBA thing, because you don't see that anymore with contracts having an option.
Yeah.
You see it in baseball. You see it in basketball. Maybe football. I don't know. Maybe you guys could attest to that more than me. But that's not something you see in hockey.
No, I think it's more of an old school thing from those days. So like Toronto got back Ken Yaremchuk, Jerome DuPont, and a fourth round draft pick in 1987 for that offer sheet. So that goes back to 1986. From this list. I could be wrong. Maybe there were other offer sheets prior to, but this looks like one of the first offer sheets in the NHL.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess you have to look at the implications of offer sheets now in the salary cap area, right? You know, beforehand, offer sheets, if the team had the money, you know, who cares about the offer sheet? More likely to match it. Salary cap area, your hands are tied in certain aspects. If the value of the contract is high, and you've got already a bunch of high contracts on your team, you're not going to be able to match. You know, sometimes you want a choice, but to let the player go unless you're clearing out the cap space.
Yeah, you talk about that Dustin Penner one. July 26, 2007, Edmonton offered him 5 years, $21.5 million from Anaheim. They did not match, and so they had to compensate Anaheim with a first, second, and third round pick in 2008.
And a lifetime supply of pancakes from IHOP.
That's right. I would take that offer.
They took the pancakes, took him out of the lineup.
Yes, sir.
We are not sponsored, but IHOP, if you're listening.
You know, something that kind of gets lost in all of this, I would say, is the fact that the average fan may not know. Most people that are listening to us probably have an idea, but these players sign those offer sheets.
Yeah.
They agree that if the contract is good and their team doesn't match, they're going there.
Yeah.
They've already made the decision. Hey, uprooting the family, taking the kid out of school. I mean, probably not if you're an RFA or, you know, 22, maybe. But you know what I mean? Like, whatever housing you have, whatever family you have, like, you're moving.
Yeah.
You're going. See you later.
We wouldn't know about it if it wasn't something they signed, because it doesn't get announced until unless they sign it. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, and there's as much as there are ones that aren't matched, there's only a few, really, if you think of the history of offer sheets, compared to the ones that are matched. And when they're matched, that means the team matches the offer sheet and the player stays with the team. There's a lot of different ones out there, but there's some notable ones too.
I'll talk about one that I saw, and it's interesting because I didn't really know this happened. I was 10 when this offer sheet was signed, but that was Matthias Olin. And the reason I mention it is because it's between the Canucks and the Leafs.
Yeah.
Matthias Olin, longtime Canuck who played very, very well for them. I didn't even know this happened. Like I said, at 10 years old, I wasn't even really paying that much attention. But in 1994, it's almost like what I did read was that it was like a grandfathered compensation, I guess, based on what the CBA was at the time, some sort of group four offer sheet. And then it was removed in the 95 CBA the year after. But 5 years at $10 million with $7.5 million in signing bonus, which, I mean, even in 97, $2 million a year, that's a pretty big contract.
Yeah.
And to commit for 5 years.
The group four offer sheet, in case you're wondering, basically what it states, and this goes back because of the grandfather, and they changed the rules over the time, but because he was drafted in 94, I believe that CBA changed after 94. So the original team was permitted to match the offer sheet, but if they didn't match, they would not receive any compensation.
Oh, wow. So
that's part of that because he's a European draft pick. So basically, right, European draft pick who remained unsigned after 2 years from being drafted. Basically, the original team is permitted to match the offer sheet, but the original team receives no compensation for that. In this case, it didn't matter because he stayed with Vancouver. But if Toronto had taken him, they wouldn't have had to give Vancouver anything to take him. So I think that's probably why Vancouver was like, no, we'll keep him because we're not getting anything for him anyway. And I'm personally, as a Canuck fan, I'm glad they did. He was one of the best defensemen in Canucks history. So,
and he hadn't even played a game for the Canucks yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is crazy when you think about it.
He started playing for the Canucks that season.
We're talking about the idea of the CBA and how that affected offer sheets and stuff like that. The little tweaks to the CBA that can affect things. You know, Calgary Flames almost made a huge mistake about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when they signed Ryan O'Reilly to an offer sheet. And in the end, you know, Colorado did match it immediately. However, if they hadn't matched it because O'Reilly had played in Europe, if they were going to start off the season with him, he would have had to gone through waivers first.
Oh.
Yeah. And so they could have actually lost the player completely.
For nothing.
And still have had to give up the compensation for it.
I wonder if the changes in CBA and more specifics on offer sheets in general have sort of accelerated that process and given GMs the ability to do so. Because, like you said, you didn't really see any activity prior to 86, maybe it wasn't even a thing. I don't know. That's way before my time again anyway. But nothing seems to have been, like, not matched up until, you know, in the history of them, there's been maybe two or three?
Yeah.
Like, completely. So, as you said, you know, with the compensation being that way or not receiving anything or that risk that you take, I wonder if that's why it really never happened.
One of the most famous... from my perspective, one of the most famous offer sheets out there, 1997, Joe Sakic was offered by the New York Rangers to Colorado. He was offered to Joe Sakic by the New York Rangers. 3 years, $21 million in 1997. That is a boatload of money. And I think that's one of the reasons why the cap is a thing, because, you know, anyone could just be like, yeah. And I mean, this is the Rangers, one of the richest teams in the league. They're like, we'll give you literally everything you want just to come and play for our team. That would have been something crazy if they had not matched that.
Jeff Bezos should listen to our podcast and sponsor us, because on Amazon Prime, there's actually a special about Joe Sakic where they talk about that.
Saving Sakic.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And how I think it was. It was either the GM at the time or the assistant GM at the time. He's in an interview, and he's basically like, I got a call from the agent saying this is what's going on. And he said, I had to make the awkward call to the GM and to say, hey, do you have this kind of money? Like, what are we going to do here? $7 million bucks. Like, no way.
Yeah. Yeah. $7 million a year back then is like, it's unheard of. So, I mean, now it's like that's pocket change for teams, but geez. When you consider 1997, like, that was huge. Yeah, there's a huge history of all these different offer sheets and teams matching it, as well as some not matched ones. But just it's just really interesting. Vancouver put an offer sheet out in July 1st, 2008 to David Backes, 3 years at $7.5 million, which St. Louis did match. So July 8th, 2008, Steve Bernier on the Vancouver Canucks. Offer sheeted by St. Louis, 1 year at $2.5 million, and Vancouver matched that.
St. Louis seems to really enjoy.
They love using the some whole leverage. Scratch my back, scratch yours. It's very interesting. So yeah, there's a huge history of offer sheets, and you know, if you guys at home are listening to this and you're like, I want to know more, there's actually a really awesome Wikipedia page that you can check out. It's got a list of all the NHL players who have been offer sheeted, and it gives you the different rules and things like that behind the group rules that they used to have, so you can kind of get an idea of like what was being compensated and things like that. Just really interesting stuff. So yeah, all these off-season moves, offer sheets, trades, all that stuff is happening here in the summertime, you know, but there's a ton of other sports happening in the summertime. You guys are huge baseball fans. I'm not much of a baseball fan, but I know you guys are. Give us a little idea of what we're kind of seeing this so far this season in baseball.
You could talk about, obviously, the geographic side of things as being a Blue Jays fan, the only major league team in Canada. What do you think about the Jays this year, though, Paul? Because they've had flashes of everything, really. What sticks out for you?
You kind of knew in the off season when they swung and missed on Ohtani that things weren't going to go well. You know, they kind of had it. They fizzled in the playoffs last year. They didn't really have a lot of momentum going into it, but they fizzled, like not winning a single game. And then you knew that they needed to make some major changes. And Ohtani was a good swing. However, most people knew that he was going to stay in the States and likely sign with the Dodgers. Put all your eggs in one basket and then pick up a couple of pieces. The team didn't excel last year, and they're showing this year they're not moving forward anytime soon. So they have 66-70 record right now. Some players have been very consistent. You know, Vladimir Guerrero wasn't necessarily at the start, but he's been great for a few months now. Varsho had a great start, but again, he started to fizzle down a bit.
Springer, where are you, buddy?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, it's been a very inconsistent season.
For those of you listening at home, he's banging a garbage can.
Trash. Maybe that'll help his batting average.
I thought you were trying to imitate the Houston Astros.
Well, he used to play for them.
They should have changed management and the coaching this past offseason. They have to do it this year. They have to. Like, the team has just been going down a rung each year for the last two or three years.
What's crazy to me, and this is from a guy who doesn't watch baseball, but I look at them from the outside, and my perspective is always like, everybody seems to be excited about these players that they're getting, like they're going to be this really great team, and then just nothing. It just, to me, it's baffling. It's got to be coaching. That's the only thing I'm thinking of. Like, it's got to be coaching. It's got to be, you know, the strategy that he's putting out there doesn't seem to be working with these players.
With the few changes they made in the offseason, specifically to their starting rotation, it wasn't much. No. But they were touted to probably have the best starting rotation in baseball, if not top three. And Gosman,
you're talking about pitchers, right?
Pitchers, yeah. Starting rotation. Gosman hasn't pitched well. Bassett's been all over the place.
Yeah.
Berríos has had both flashes of great and terrible. Rodriguez has been injured. They originally wanted Bowden Francis to take that fifth spot. He didn't really work out. Rodriguez, who they signed as a North American free agent or a
international.
International, thank you. Yeah. International free agent. He was injured for a while. He pitched okay. Velocity's there. He doesn't have, had the advantage maybe of coming in where nobody's seen him pitch, but injuries have hurt his season. Francis is now pitching well now after it's kind of late.
Yeah.
But, and again, the underwhelming batting averages and their home run totals have been way down. It's just Bo Bichette getting hurt and not playing well. It's just kind of like a railroad off the tracks or a train off the tracks this season so far.
Well, this is why I lean on the fact that the coaching and the management needs to change. It's just some of the moves they've been doing to try to build some chemistry with this team just make no sense. I've talked about this with Brandon quite a few times in the past that I think the Varsho trade was just absolutely, you know, dung thrown on the field kind of thing. You had a blue chip prospect of Moreno that, in my opinion, probably would have been enough for Varsho, because Varsho, while he had a really good year the year that they traded for him, he still wasn't completely proven. To give up Gurriel, who was a consistent hitter for the Blue Jays, included in that deal, I knew as soon as they made that deal that they shot themselves in the foot. And Arizona, with their team now, is showing that.
Prior to that trade, like, Gurriel was an infielder. He said that he had problems with his arm, throwing, you know, that dead arm or whatever. Josh Donaldson went through the same thing for a season or two.
That's right.
And he was an infielder, and they made the bold move to move him to the outfield, and it was like the greatest thing they ever did. That management decision was great. And then a season and a half later, trade, see you later. And I actually liked the trade. I did think that it was too much to give up.
Yeah.
Varsho was coming off a great season, and defensively he's been fantastic.
No, he's one of the best in baseball.
But there you go, right? If it doesn't all translate, and it doesn't all translate at the same time, you're not going to win ball games.
No.
You're not going to win ball games.
Yeah, it's been a pretty crazy summer when we think about, you know, all the different sports. I mean, there's golf, there's baseball, there's the Olympics. We had a lot of stuff to cheer about this year. But, you know, on top of that, going to our other favorite topic, movies. There's been some pretty awesome movies this summer, too.
A good summer for release of movies, and I think it's going to continue along the way the rest of the year. The 2024 for movie releases in general has been pretty good.
And it's both streaming and in theaters. Like, there's some pretty awesome movies on both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah, I've loved actually a lot of the films that they've come out with this year. One notable, I think we can all agree, Deadpool and Wolverine was...
It was my number three in my list. Yeah, it's so funny. I cannot wait for that movie to come out streaming because I want to watch it again and again and
again. Me too, yeah.
Because there's just so much that you're you have to watch it again just to pick up on some of the Easter eggs that they have in this movie. Incredible movie. Axel F, the new Beverly Hills Cop movie. This is from somebody who watched the originals and loved the originals. I grew up with them. Loved this movie. I thought it was so entertaining. So fun. And it was like, it was like his comedy. Cause sometimes, you know, they bring it up, they bring back a movie like a remake or whatever with the original characters, and it just kind of fails because it feels like the jokes are a bit forced and stuff like that. But his jokes in this movie really felt like I was watching, you know, Beverly Hills Cop 3 all over again.
I would agree with that. The way they made the jokes, the soundtrack,
yeah,
everything was basically trying to recreate what it was in the 80s. And I think they did that. But I'll disagree a little bit, and I won't get into too much because I know Paul hasn't seen it. But I'll disagree a little bit with the fact that I thought the character was a little disconnected from what Axel Foley was in the first three movies. Mm-hmm. Now, when you find out and see what's happened in his life since the third movie, maybe it's done on purpose.
Yeah, like maybe there's a reason.
Maybe there's a reason that his character is a little disconnected, and I think you could probably make that argument.
That's
too.
Kind of what I was thinking when I watched the movie. I totally understand what you're saying. Like, I definitely felt that way, and then I thought the same thing. Like, maybe there's a reason behind it based on the storyline, right?
You guys watch movies more for that reason. Yeah. I don't. Yeah. But hey, maybe you're rubbing.
Maybe
off
you're
on
getting
me a little
there.
Bit.
Yeah, working your way up.
But I mean, honestly, just before we continue, and I know we're going to get into a little bit, I sort of feel the same way, like you had mentioned, you know, bringing in characters from an original movie years later.
Yeah.
I feel the same way with Die Hard, right? You know, the first three Die Hards, they were all within, say, like a 7-year period or an 8-year period max, all three movies. And then you don't see one for 20 years. Well, I found that John McClane wasn't John McClane when he came back for, was it Live Free, Die Hard? Was that the fourth one?
The one with Justin Long?
Yeah, exactly. I liked the movie.
Yeah.
But if you really psychoanalyze the character and really watch, it's not really John McClane, in my opinion. It's just Bruce Willis playing another action character.
Yeah, calling
himself. That's the way I looked at it. I just didn't get enough reconnection.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. So you didn't have that same feeling watching the movie.
Yeah. Exactly.
Twisters, actually, just kind of segueing from what you're talking about, because Twisters is another movie that was made originally years ago, and it's a new movie with the same name and same kind of idea. What did you think of that movie?
Standalone sequel. I was really hoping for a little more connection to the first one.
Yeah.
I know, Paul, you just saw it. What do you think?
It was entertaining. I would say it was definitely an entertaining movie. When you're trying to do, I guess, a comparison, the fact that it's kind of like a semi-sequel, it is and it isn't. It just didn't capture you the same way that the original Twister did. You know, Helen Hunt was, I believe, just coming off a Academy Award win, actually, and Bill Paxton was still had a pretty good name for himself. So you had actors that were really, really engaging, really, really interesting, and the story, actually, you know, like, you never seen a movie about tornadoes before. You know, you cared for the characters, but you were very interested in the visual effects and everything that were happening, and it actually had a pretty engaging story. I found Twisters, on the other hand, it felt a little rushed in the beginning, like creating this trauma for the main character, compared to, you know, Helen Hunt's trauma when she was a kid. Mm-hmm. It was as a kid compared to, you know, the actor Daisy Edgar Jones. Her trauma was as a teenager, but you fast forwarded only 5 years later.
Like late teens, too.
Yeah.
Like she's already almost an adult when this happens. I totally get that. Let me ask you this question. And I agree with you, by the way, with what you said. Do you think, let's say, hypothetically, the original Twister doesn't exist and they come out with just this movie, how would you rate it at that point?
Now, we're talking about on the scale.
Yeah, like if it's a standalone movie called Twisters, there is no such thing as Twister with Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt.
Yeah.
Do you have the same opinion?
Yeah, I'd say it's an above average movie. It's not an average movie. It's a slightly above average movie. It's
definitely when you think of like the CGI and like the graphics, like definitely make it appealing in that way.
100%. Yeah, it's above average movie. Like, I like the actors, funny enough. Glenn Powell is, you know, he was in the
Mr. Everyman, literally in everything.
he was in the most recent Top Gun, obviously, and like his character, he him as an actor, he's awesome. And I do like Daisy Edgar Jones as well. She's done a couple of good shows and movies so far. Good actors, but I think they needed a better story.
I don't like this question. I really don't like this question.
It makes you think too much, right?
It does, like, yeah. And probably you're right. I would say, you know, maybe a 6.5, 7 out of 10 if it is just, you know, you've never seen the other one. Yeah. I would say in the difference that I found in this one, something that stuck out right away was that the information about tornadoes in this movie, it's almost like they just expect you to know how a tornado worked.
Right.
And okay, all of a sudden we're going to put these sensors up and we're going to save the world. Whereas in Twister, I wouldn't even say there's more of an explanation, but you get a feeling more of how dangerous this tornado is. Like, give me a freaking break. You're going to drive into a tornado?
Yeah.
No, you're not.
No. Yeah.
No,
yeah,
Glenn, no. That's
a really good point.
That.
That's a really, and it's funny because as I was watching that, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, how come in the original Twister movie, they couldn't just do that? Right. Whereas in this one, it's like, yeah, no problem. It just seemed to me like too far-fetched a little bit.
Yeah, they hinted at it in the first one with a couple of close calls where, of course, the tornado evaporates right before it eats them.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fear is there. You can feel it where it's almost like a satire with the new movie where they say, woo, we're going out on a Friday night. Let's go get a tornado. Well, let's not get drunk. Exactly. Let's go through a tornado.
Exactly. There's a lot of notable movies that came out this year. You know, Inside Out 2 is one that I can relate. I've seen it recently with my family, and I loved it. I thought it was a wonderful movie, and it had a great sequel to the original as well.
So I had just seen the original mm-hmm. because I hadn't before, and I knew that I had seen a preview for the sequel, and I thought, this actually looks really cute. And I remember a few years ago kind of seeing a preview or, you know, ads, YouTube videos or whatever for the first one. You're kind of like, oh, I mean, yeah, chuckle a little bit here and there, but man, whatever. It's not really up my alley. And then we thought, you know what, let's sit down and watch the first one. And it was pretty good. I thought it was cute. And then the second one, it's cute. It's relatable. It's everything that people are now talking about that maybe never used to, as far as your mental health and how your feelings go and your emotions and what it's like being a teenager starting puberty and acceptance. And like, it really, you haven't seen it yet, have you? So it's basically, it plays on everything that people really do go through at that stage of their lives, wanting to be popular in high school and the effects of, you know, having friends and going to a bigger place. And are you still going to be friends? You want to be popular? It's just, people are torn in so many different directions. And I just think it really captures that well. And to top it off, you know, it's full of laughs, it's full of good voice character actors, a lot of recognizable ones. Lewis Black, have you seen the first one?
I have, yes.
Yeah, so Lewis Black as Anger or whatever, just classic.
I will say classic. One disappointment about the movie was that Bill Hader did not return as Fear.
It's interesting you say that, because when we were watching the second one, and I hadn't clued in until you just mentioned that, when he was talking, I went, oh, yeah, Bill Hader.
Yeah. And also,
and then Tiff goes, no, that's not Bill Hader. And I went, well, he was in the first one.
He was, yeah. Bill Hader was in the first one. He played Fear. And then also, Mindy Kaling played Disgust in the original. She was not in this one either. She didn't return either. I have a feeling it's just probably because he was working on another project, and she was probably working on another project as well. But, you know, sometimes that stuff can come out and kind of take you away from the movie. I thought the guy they chose to play Fear, Tony Hale, his voice is so separate from Bill Hader's that it's obvious. And so when I was watching it, it kept bothering me that it wasn't Bill Hader. Like, I remember thinking like, oh, that should be Bill Hader, but it's not. However, the girl that plays Disgust, Liza Lapira, her voice is very similar to Mindy Kaling. So I felt like she could have passed for it. No problem. I didn't even know it was not Mindy Kaling until I looked it up on IMDb. So yeah, it's just interesting how, like, when you have a cartoon or a, you know, a family movie like that, where it's voiced and it's not the same voice, it can really, really pull you apart, pull you away from it. But that's what it did to me anyway.
What else have you seen this summer, Paul?
I saw the prequel to Quiet Place, which there's Quiet Place 1, Quiet Place 2, and then there's the prequel came out in, I believe it was June there. It was Quiet Place Day 1. Wasn't directed by John Krasinski like the first two was, and obviously had Emily Blunt and John Krasinski in the first two, but not in the prequel here. They did have Digimon Hounsou, I believe is the actor's name. He was in it, but the trailer was a bit misleading for day one. Not in very long. I won't give too much away on that. The first two just had such an interesting tone to them in regards to obviously it being a quiet movie, but having the intensity of aliens that if you hear a slight sound, they're going to kill you.
I fully recommend the first two Quiet Place movies to you, by the way. I just haven't seen this one, so I can't recommend it. But
yeah, I'd say this one was definitely entertaining. It was still entertaining, but it did not have the same kind of intensity and feel as the first two did.
Mm-hmm. It was more laid back for sure. It was more laid back. I'm still looking for more information. Now, I don't know if that's because there's more coming in more movies.
Yeah.
Information about
this all went down. Yeah, how this all went down for sure. It's still good. I would definitely check it out.
Yeah.
Definitely check it out.
It looks good. I just haven't had a chance to see it yet. So, I mean, there's, you know, lots of great movies this summer. I've always kind of wondered, you know, what about summer releases in history? Like, there's been so many epic movies released in the summertime. And I think sometimes you'll look at it and go, I didn't even realize that was a summer movie. Do you guys have sort of a top three summer movies of all time? So summer movies, once again, are movies specifically released in the summertime. I have picked three myself. Do you have three movies that you think you could say are your top, you know, top three summer releases?
I do. But before we do that, I just want to, I think it would be interesting to check out the movies that were released like the year we were each born.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Definitely.
So I know that you are an 82 baby,
1982, Joe. Yes.
And what a banger.
Yeah.
E.T.
Good one to start
with. Extraterrestrial.
Love that movie. Me and the kids have seen that movie a few times. And I have some great memories of watching that as a kid. Not realizing, of course, it came out the year I was born. So that's pretty cool.
Do you know why E.T.'s eyes were so big? He saw his phone bill.
Phone home.
It would cost a lot of money.
And I'm the only one here that's not a dad. Paul, what was the one the year you were born?
It was funny enough, it was actually part of my my top five movies of all time on the last podcast. Star Wars Episode VI, Return of the Jedi, is when I came out the same year I was born.
1983. Young buck.
And we alluded to the series earlier, but the year I was born, it was Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah. Okay, so we know what movies were out when we were born. Now, let's talk about our favorite summer movies of all time.
I will start with my number three. It had Michael J. Fox. It had an amazing car that was made of stainless steel at the time and was very popular at the time. And
Risky
that would
business?
Be...
No, that's Tom Cruise.
That's Tom Cruise. Back to the Future is my number three for summer release movies.
86?
Leave 85, actually, because they talked about 1985.
I didn't write down the years on mine, so...
85, yeah.
Okay, so I went with my number three is a comedy, and it's one of my favorite comedies. It's one of these comedy movies you can watch it year in, year out, and it's always the same. I watch the Christmas version, too, year in, year out, every year. This is National Lampoon's Vacation, starring Mr. Chevy Chase, who apparently, by the way, is very difficult to work with. This is what I've heard. Not, you know, if you're listening to this, Chevy, this is just what I've heard. But one of my favorite comedy movies is just something I can watch all the time, like over and over and over again. And it's just a fun movie to watch. So
my number three came out in 1996. Will Smith, Bill Pullman, Vivica Fox, Jeff Goldblum, Independence Day.
Oh, yeah.
Classic. Yeah. One of those movies, too, that it's like, and I love these movies, especially when you enjoy them. I think we alluded to it on our last episode a little bit, but it's those long movies. Like, this movie's like 2.5 hours, right? One of those ones that you just never want to end. It just makes it so much better knowing that it's long. You're going to sit down, you're going to watch a movie. You don't have to, you know, worry about picking something else for your night if it's only an hour and a half or an hour and 20 minutes long.
Totally.
You got, yeah, we're riding this. We're in this for the long haul.
It's such a fun movie. And like all the ensemble cast, like every single character is like fun and exciting. And I loved it. Yeah. Very entertaining. By the way, National Lampoon's Vacation came out in 1983.
My number two, it's a comic book movie. There's many I could have chosen from Iron Man, Avengers that were part of the comic universe, but I'm a huge Christopher Nolan lover, and Dark Knight came out in the summer of 2008. It kind of actually got me started on really enjoying Nolan movies. He had done Batman Begins, obviously, prior to Dark Knight, and one of my other movies I really enjoy, Memento, which is a movie done backwards, which is really, really fascinating to watch. But Dark Knight, shot with an IMAX camera, the visuals in that movie were stunning. The story and Heath Ledger's Joker was completely incredible. Maniacal.
Yeah.
It was really, really, it was a really, really interesting movie for being a comic book movie.
My number two, released in 2009, the following year, Quentin Tarantino directed The Inglorious Bastards.
Oh, great movie.
Absolutely love this movie. Brandon and I were talking about this earlier, and he's super anti awesome movies, apparently. But no, he looks for different things, and this movie is wonderful for me. It's one of those things where if you could have a movie where you get your revenge on Adolf Hitler, like, this is the movie to watch. Oh, 100%. For sure. It's wonderful. I can't say enough about it, but yeah, definitely. If you have not watched it, check it out. It's a pretty awesome movie, and it is your typical Quentin Tarantino movie. There's a lot of violence and a lot of dialogue, but it's worth it in the end. Yeah, released in August of 2009. So, you know, only a few days ago, basically, in 2009. So that's pretty cool.
That's very cool.
Late great 1998 for my number two, Armageddon. I for me, it's probably that whole era. Like, literally, my top three summer picks are all within 4 years.
Yep,
that's crazy.
Now, I don't know if that's a point in time in my life where I just relied on movies, and this was kind of where I got to, and these were the movies I saw, and these were the movies that were coming out at the time. Because 1998, I was 11 in that summer, and Armageddon. I have a thing for natural disaster movies. I guess you can call it a natural disaster. You know. Twister, volcanoes, all this crap, asteroid looming towards the Earth, the end of civilization as we know it. Bruce Willis, who of course at the time was top notch, you know, at the top of his game. Liv Tyler, pretty well, or pretty unknown, I think, still at that point.
At that point, yeah.
Steve Buscemi, a young
Steve Buscemi was one of my favorite actors.
What is the guy who played Colonel Sharp? William Fichtner.
Yep.
That was probably one of the first movies I ever saw him in. It probably was the first movie I ever saw him in.
Michael Clark Duncan. Yeah. Owen Wilson.
Yeah. Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Armageddon for me.
I just looked up a movie as you were talking about that, because I remember very distinctly that this movie came out around the same time as Deep Impact, which, very similar plot idea. But I liked both movies. I thought both movies were really good in their own way.
Yeah, one's about a comet, one's about an asteroid.
That's right. And yeah, exactly.
There's a few movies in the history that have been like this, where like the same year tandem movies have been released.
Yeah.
Just the year prior to, you had Dante's Peak and Volcano.
Yeah, that's right.
Paul, what's your number one?
My number one, I'm pretty sure every kid felt this when they were kids. You loved dinosaurs growing up, to see them brought to life in Jurassic Park, which is my number one, 1993.
Honestly, I would have questioned you had you not chosen that as your number one.
For a summer release movie, and the fact, again, you're out of school as a kid. I think I was 10 years old at the time. My parents took me to see it twice in the theater, just because I was just so captivated seeing a T-Rex for real, seeing my favorite dinosaur at the time, which was Triceratops, seeing that and having humans be up close to that, like, and just ultra realistic movie. You know, like, you've seen animatronic dinosaurs or really hokey bad computer generated dinosaurs in the past, and to see one that was like super realistic, a movie super realistic, was great.
Like you said, every kid loved the movie, loved the dinosaurs. I don't know if a single friend that I had that didn't have a Jurassic Park toy, you know.
And it was a really interesting story throughout the entire movie. Like, funny enough, I read the book 2 years after the movie came out. And, you know, every kid has a good imagination, but actually seeing the movie really helped the visualization in my mind about everything that was happening in the book. Obviously, most movies are done very differently than the books are, and certainly Jurassic Park was done quite differently. But, you know, some of the stuff that you could visualize in your head after reading the book was fantastic. And like you were saying, went all out for the movie. Like you get a guy like John Williams, who was one of the greatest composers at the time. That theme is going to be iconic for forever.
Let me ask you guys, before I give you to my number one, let me ask you guys, who's your favorite actor? You have to choose one actor.
Just based upon history of films that he's done, and he's really good. Anthony Hopkins would be mine.
Good choice.
So I would say my favorite actor has got to be good old Denzel.
Denzel Washington.
Any single movie that I see that he's in, I'm watching it. I don't care if it's good or bad.
The reason I ask you guys is because my number one movie that was released in the summertime is starring my favorite actor of all time. That's Tom Hanks. Literally everything Tom Hanks has ever been in is a movie that I've loved. The movie Big came out when I was just a child, and I loved that movie from the get-go. It's a wonderful movie. This movie in particular, though, is in 1998. I was 16 years old, Saving Private Ryan. One of my favorite war movies and incredible movies. Tom Hanks,
very good movie,
is very deservedly a winner in this movie. So, yeah, incredible movie. And I'm just so, you know, it's a lot of it is because my favorite actor's in it. But it just the movie itself is wonderful. Barry Pepper, who is from the area.
Campbell River, I think.
Campbell River from the island in the movie plays the sniper. And yeah, it's just everybody in it. Vin Diesel's wonderful in it, you know, like Giovanna Ribisi, like just incredible characters, incredible actors. And we are lucky to have had this movie made, I think.
I think we're going to be at a 6 count out of 9 for 90s movies.
Yeah.
As our biggest. Now, I wonder if that's an age thing. Because we're all relatively close in age? Or is it just the latter half, specifically of the 90s, was just revolutionary for film, right? And I mean, my number one in 95 is Die Hard 3 with a Vengeance. And again, we had alluded to this last episode as well, and I had mentioned that I wonder if it has something to do with when you watch the movie, because this was the first Die Hard movie that I watched. I hadn't seen the first one, and I hadn't seen the second one when this one was released. So when this came out, and I don't think we saw it in the theaters, I think we ended up renting it, but we watched it as a family, and it was just so fantastic. Of course, the comedic relief you get in such intense situations, is at least that's what they're trying to portray, guys like Samuel L. Jackson, and how just the John McClane character, which I found out, of course, that happens in the first two movies as well. Just that side of him that creates that character. Again, when we mentioned that later on, I didn't find that connection with the other movies, but that one for me, Jeremy Irons, who I'd never even heard of before at the time, just love that character. And then, of course, then you connect the dots when I saw the first one finally, and, you know, the brother situation and that, I don't know, just for me, it has everything. And that was my top pick for my summer blockbuster.
That seems to be a pattern for you as a child, is watching movies like almost in reverse.
Yeah.
You
Ghostbusters.
Know?
Yeah. Another example I thought of. I saw the second Ghostbusters before I saw the first
really?
One. RoboCop. I think I saw the second one before I saw the first one.
And RoboCop 1, I mean, we could do a whole other podcast talking about the RoboCop movies, but RoboCop 1 is the best of all of them.
Oh, 100%.
And even like to say it's one of the better movies of the 80s, just from the storytelling perspective. We'll talk about that in a whole other podcast. But it's definitely you know, Die Hard with a Vengeance. All the Die Hard movies up until with a Vengeance, incredible movies. I can't say the same for the newer ones, but that's just because they kind of take the story to another place that probably takes you away from the original ones. But yeah, absolutely, I'm with you. Great movie.
Funny enough with this list, like, because we were focusing just on summer movies, there are movies that were on my all-time list that could have been included on this list, but, you know, for reasons that I want to focus just on giving new content, you know, except Inception and Star Wars are two that I could have included on this list, but I decided not to because I really wanted to focus on those summer releases.
Just, there's so many different choices you can make, for sure. We got so much more to talk about. So if you guys are enjoying what you're listening to, make sure you come on back and join us again for another Puck and Pod. Boys, how do you feel?
I'm ready to roll into the weekend.
Feel fucking great.
Dialing it in.
Fucking great. Thank you guys once again for joining us. Until the next time, my name is Joe.
My name is Brandon.
And I'm Paul.
We will catch you guys in episode number 3.